So our goal this afternoon is to reflect on a message of the shofar that we may be familiar with or maybe never even thought of through the limud, the sources that you had in front of you. One way to begin this discussion is to reflect together on the various messages that are associated with the mitzvah of shofar, the sounding of the shofar. So if you look on the Kollel bookmark, which you will be getting in Yirtzeh Hashem this Yontif, so we think about lots of different themes that are associated with the sound of the shofar. The aisle, the ram, that reminds us of the Akedah. The sound of the shofar at Har Sinai. The sound of the shofar reminding us of the ultimate redemption. Tekka b'shofar gadol l'cheruseinu. Coronating the king. Rav Sadia Gaon has a whole bunch. And maybe the most famous one is the one that you saw in the Rambam, where the Rambam associates shofar with... No? What's that? The Rambam associates shofar with tshuva. Yeah. It's a wake-up call. It's an alarm clock. Right? That's probably the most famous one. Yeah. Wake up. That's what we're doing. We got this is Elul. That's why we're blowing it before. So, those are themes that are familiar to us with the mitzvah of shofar. Great. Let's put those on the side for a second. If someone were to ask you, how do you know what is the source and the origin of the sounds that we blow on Rosh Hashanah? So where would you send them? Where would you find that? You would find it, you open the Tanakh, and you find the story of Sisera, but actually, in the story of Sisera, it doesn't say anything about what shofar is. All it says is Vatiyabev Aim Sisera, and the word Vatiyabev, Yud, Bez, Bev, is the word Yevava, which is associated, according to the Gemara, with a particular type of sound. Now, there's a beautiful insight here, which is not on our regularly scheduled program, but I cannot miss the opportunity to share it with you. So can we devote 2 minutes to this amazing vart, even though it's not on the schedule?
Sure.
All right, you ready for this amazing vart? Okay. I was not planning for this, but once we've got it, I'm at the edge of my seat, literally. So probably 20 years ago, when I was in YU, I heard an insight from maybe 25 now, from Rabbi Aaron Kahn, who's one of the elder Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva. He's also a rabbi in Brooklyn. He had a vart. He had a vort. I don't know where he got this vort from, but he had a vort on this nekuda, this element, that according to the Gemara, we have a specific technical limud, which we'll talk about in a minute, of how you get the sounds of the shofar, but there's a tradition to blow 100 sounds that's associated with the crying of the mother of Sisera, the Canaanite general who was killed in a battle between the Jews and the Canaanites. And the verse describes in Shiras Devorah that the mother of Sisera was awaiting his return, and he never came back because he had been killed by a heroic woman. Her name is Yael. So Yael kills Sisera, and the mother is sitting at home wailing, Vatiyabev Aim Sisera. So Rabbi Kahn said an amazing vort. What does the sound of the shofar have to do with the mother of Sisera? What does it have to do with anything? So he had an amazing ha'ara. He said, if we understand like the Rambam that the sound of the shofar is associated with tshuva, so what happens in tshuva? A person has to come to a realization that they need to change because we are experts at rationalizing. This is a point which is driven home by the psychologist, the eminent expert on human behavior, Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Tversky, in his book on Yom Kippur. He talks about self-delusion. It's also the topic of a very interesting recent podcast called Hidden Brain, hosted by a guy by the name of Shachar Vidantam, who has an entire episode about how we are constantly rationalizing. So we do all kinds of averas, and we rationalize them all the time. So what happens to the mother of Sisera? So first, when Madua Boshu Pa'amei Markavosav, why is he delayed? So first, she gives explanations.
Rechem Racham Asayim L'Rosh Gover. I forget the exact quote off the top of my head in the Shiras Devorah. She's explaining to herself, you know why the general is late? Because he's collecting so much loot, so many captives, it's taking him forever. It's a good explanation, right? And then she has another explanation. But it's still disturbing. So she's kind of like krechzing, groaning. But then what happens? Then, as you say in Hebrew, nafala asimon, the realization, the finality, the truth sets in. And that opens the floodgates of, oy, oy, oy! So Rabbi Kahn said, that is the sound of the shofar. The trua, what is legally called a trua in the Chumash, is referred to in the Gemara as a suffix, as a doubt, as either a shvarim or a trua. And because we're not sure, we blow two. We blow a shvarim, which the Gemara calls is genuche gonach, krechzing, groaning. That's shvarim. Shvarim is genuche gonach, it's groaning. But after the shvarim comes the trua. Ay, 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 ay. Yolule yolal. So, says Rabbi Kahn, says the Gemara, that is the trua, that is the transformation of the tshuva. First, we rationalize, and we have some krechzing. But then, when we're ready, really ready to face the music, then we hit the trua. That's what has to do with the mother of Sisera, who goes through that same process of realization. What a vart, right?
Yep.
Amazing. Anyway, that's just bonus for today. That you put in your pocket, that's just a bonus.
Wait,
let's get back.
What was the tekiah, Rabbi?
Tekiah is the front and the back, but the trua, that's the feeling of the brokenness, which we're not going to focus on today. But anyway, coming back here, was Kedai just to come for that, no?
Absolutely.
No. Oh. So if someone were to ask you, what's the source of the sounds that we blow, they say, look in the Chumash, right? Well, you look in the Chumash, you don't find anything. It just says that Rosh Hashanah is Yom Trua. It's a day of sounding. Or it's Zichron Trua, remembering the sounds. So the Gemara says, oh, I have a drasha, I have a series of rabbinic interpretations that are going to anchor us in explaining this rule, this din, that you have to have a certain number of sounds. So the Gemara has a whole drasha, which I think you saw, if you look, pay careful attention in the Gemara, in Rosh Hashanah, that first you have to have a tekiah, then you have to have the middle sound, which was the questionable sound. We're not sure exactly. That's why we mentioned different ways of sounding that. And then the final sound, a tekiah la'achareah. And you have that three times. So Minat Torah, biblically, you need nine sounds. Tekiah, trua, tekiah, three times. Where do you get that from? From Yovel. The shofar of Yovel, the Jubilee year, when they would sound the shofar on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippurim, they would sound the shofar of Yovel. So you're thinking to yourself, is there any takeaway, is there any connection other than the legal connection between the shofar of Rosh Hashanah that we sound every year and the shofar of Yovel of the Jubilee year? If you think about the themes that we talked about before, they don't really seem commensurate with each other. They're not really in consonance. On Rosh Hashanah, we're talking about tshuva, we're talking about geula, redemption, we're talking about malchus, and in Yom Kippur, we're talking about Yovel, where we are emancipating slaves and returning property, fields, to their original owners. So what's that have to do with it? So that's the question. So perhaps a way to understand the connection in this light is to go back to the Shoresh, to the source of Rosh Hashanah. We say, Hayom Haras Olam. Today is the, it's a hard word to translate. It literally means the conception of the world. It actually means the birthday of the world. And it's also important to know whether you are Ashkenazi or Sephardi, because if you tell somebody who's from Edot HaMizrach or pronounces something Sephardic, you tell them Hayom Haras Olam, you mean to say today the world is destroyed. That's not what it means. Haras is with a suf. So speaking Ashkenazic pronunciation, just to be clear, Haras in this context is Harat. The Hara means to become pregnant, means to conceive. It's the creation of the world. So what day of creation is Rosh Hashanah commemorating?
Sixth.
That's right. Sixth. How do I know that? That's what the Ran points out in the end of Rosh Hashanah, Rabbi Nissim, in his commentary in the back of the Talmud. He says, the world was actually begun on the 25th day of Elul, so to speak. Rosh Hashanah is the anniversary of the creation of human beings, man. So that was the sixth day of creation, which means that the first day of Tishrei is the sixth day of creation. From this perspective, the creation of the sun, not so significant. The creation of the fish, not so significant. The creation of light, not significant. What's significant is the creation of human beings. So what happened in this creation? What are we commemorating in the creation of mankind? So as you saw, and some of you may be familiar with this emphasis, this dichotomy, this diuk, from Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's work. Anybody know which work focused on this story of creation? Adam 1 and Adam 2. Lonely Man of Faith. So, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, and you saw it inside, that there is a host of distinctions. There are a host of distinctions. There is a very strong distinction between the first presentation, you could say, of creation, and the second presentation of the creation. In Perek Beis, right? Let's get the psukim in front of you. You have them there. In Perek Aleph, the end, in Pasuk Chavav and Chav Zayin, and in Perek Beis, Psukim Dalad through Zayin. What are some of the obvious differences in the creation story in Perek Aleph versus Perek Beis?
In the first one, it's all sequential.
Okay.
And the second one talks about man, and then once man is created, everything else sort of turns the light on, because there was no need for anything else until man came. So that's when that's when the rains came, that's when...
Okay, good. So certain things are brought into the world in the context of the second story of creation. I'm talking about the creation per se. What the difference is, yeah?
Dr. Birnbaum shed light to me that the first creation, everything was good and nice. The second creation, we ended up with the serpent and all the other issues right after. And it's
okay, good. That's also in the context of the second creation, we find the story of the Nachash. But I'm talking about the description of the creation per se, it itself. Look at the psukim carefully, which was in our special guided questions.
Well, the difference in how man was created.
Okay.
First one, he was created B'Tzelem Elokim. Second one is created Me'afar. So the first one is the idea of how man's going to be created. The second one is the physical way in which it happened.
Okay. I'm not sure that they're not both physical, but they are definitely presented slightly differently. Good. Yeah, what were we going to say?
The second creation speaks only of vegetation, but the first creation speaks of vegetation, fish, birds, cows.
Okay, yes, in the context. I have it for a second. I'll just read it to you. So, in the first one, it talks about the role of man ruling over the natural world, right? And that's very much what Rabbi Soloveitchik is focused on in his essay as opposed to the second one. I'm looking at the creation itself. In Pasuk of Zion, in Perek Beis, it says, Vayivra Elokim es Ha'adam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created man through the construct of Berea. That's first of all. The word bria is different than as appears the second time in Pasuk Zion when it says vayitzer. So bria and yitzira, slightly different. But you notice the first time man is created, zachar unekeva bara osam. He created them as zachar and nekeva. It doesn't say man and woman. It says male and female. Meaning, the first creation, you are given a biological, scientific frame through which you view this creature. It's zachar and nekeva. That's how it's created.
Together as one unit.
Yes, that's what Gemara points out in Erevin. It was one being. Even the second time, it's one being. But here, the context here is it's Zachar Nekeva. It's like a scientific analysis. As opposed to the second time, yes, it's true that he is created from Afar Minhu Adama, but there is a very significant addition. Vayipach ba'apov nishmas chayim. There is a soul which is blown into mankind. You notice there's a different name of God. I don't know if you paid close attention. Yes? What's the difference?
It's
yes! Say it again for him.
Elohim versus Adam.
The first time Adam is created, it is with the shame Elohim. So what is the... Let's do a math game. What is... I'm going to write it here with a dash so we don't have a problem erasing it. What is the numerical value of Elohim? Math, folks. Aleph is 1. Lamed is 30. Hey is 5. So now we're at 36. Okay. So how many are we at? 86. Good. Okay. See this word? Hateva, the nature. What's the gematria of the word Hateva, the nature? The natural world? What's that?
You wouldn't have written it.
That's right, 86. I share this with you because this is a great way of remembering that the name Elohim, which comes from the Hebrew, there's a secular word which is associated, which means power, that is El. When you refer to what people associated with power, they call them Elohim. Like, they thought that they were gods because they had power. Elohim achirim. They're not. They're not Elohim. They're Elohim. But El, that's why a Bez in a court has certain authority. And therefore it says Elohim nitzav ba'adas El. El is some entity that has power. So court of law has power. So it's referred to as El. That power is in the construct or the contours of what we understand as nature. That's din. That's why a court is referred to as El. That's the power that's associated with din, with judgment, with strictness. And judgment is associated with Elohim and Teva, nature. What's that?
I don't understand that connection.
Good. When you talk about din, strict judgment, you mean to say that you do the crime, you do the time. There is an exact science about how to mete out the consequences of an action. That's din. That's judgment. Strict judgment. If someone were to say to you, this person had an extenuating circumstance, they had a condition, they had something that influenced their behavior, they were, generally speaking, well-behaved before that. In the realm of din, does that matter? No. It only matters in the realm of rachamim, compassion. That's beyond din. In the natural world, let's say you have a little fish. You have a beautiful fishula. And this fishula is swimming around in the ocean, and it comes across, lo aleinu, a shark. So in the realm of teva, is there anything called rachamim? Can the little fishula say, you know, Echmein, my mother was eaten by a shark. My two brothers-in-law were eaten by sharks. I am the only remaining member of my family to carry on the lineage. Would you have rachmanis? It's such a thing. Ain't davar kaze. In nature, you do the crime, you do the time, there are fixed rules. And those rules, they don't bend. There's no such thing as bending the laws of nature. And in many respects, nature is unforgiving, you could even say. What did Thomas Hobbes say? Living in the state of nature is nasty, brutish, and short. Exactly. But there's another way to live. That's not using the name of Elohim. That's not about power. That's about transcendence. Haya, it was. Hove, it is. V'yiye, and it will be. It was before the world was created. It is while the world is created, and it will be afterwards. It transcends the limitations of the world. That's the Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. When is that introduced? The second time. The first creation is the backbone of Din. B'tchila Rashi says, Olam HaMachshava, it was God's plan. There has to be a baseline of judgment. But on top of that, there needs to be, there's the only way that you can function in life is that we're nature, by nature we are going to make mistakes. We're human beings. We have to have second chances. We have to have rachamim. So in addition, that what complements the din? Rachamim. What was created on Rosh Hashanah, the sixth day of creation, what was the chiddush in a certain sense? The chiddush was?
Din.
No. Din was created before. Din existed when we had fish. Rachamim, exactly. Compassion. So the chiddush is that when Hashem, when He blew into us, Vayipach ba'ap of nishmas chayim, when He blew into us that spirit of life, He blew into the world, so to speak, the power of rachmanus, of compassion. Another way of looking at that same point is He blew into us the capacity to live beyond the confines, the shackles of nature. The natural world is by definition finite. It begins and it ends. But the spiritual world, the world of Havaya, of Rachmim, of Shem Hashem, that transcends, that's not limited by nature. Nature, by definition, din, these are all limits. That's why the name of Hashem that's associated with din is Shakai, Sha'amar lo'olamo dai. They said there's a limit. But the expansiveness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, going beyond those limits, that's rachmanus. That's breaking boundaries. That, in a certain sense, is the greatest expression of freedom. You are not limited. You're not bounded by nature. You're free, in a certain sense, even from the clutches of death. Death only exists in the realm of Teva. But in the realm of Havaya, your neshama never dies. So now, if you understand that, we don't have much time to discuss this, but many of the Sfarim say a beautiful idea that I saw this summer, that the concept of zechira, of remembering, zechira does not mean just you forgot something and now you remembered it. Zechira on a deeper level means to take something and to return to its source. Lizkor, when we say Hashem, you should remember us, it doesn't mean God forgot us. It means Hashem, you should see the source of us. The source of us and our parents, our grandparents, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Liskor means to come back to the root of something. So Yom HaZikaron is the day that we come back to the root of creation. The Avod of Rosh Hashanah is to go back to the day that man was created. We're going back to that Shoresh. What happened on that day? God blew into our nostrils the breath of life. So what do? We blow the shofar. That's the deepest secret of the shofar, is that we are blowing, vayipach, we are demonstrating that we are mamlech Hashem, we are blowing the actual breath that He gave us on this day, we're going back to that shoresh of the blowing. But now we can understand, the pasuk says in Tehillim, Olo Elokim besrua, Hashem bekol shofar. The source of the day, the basic foundation of creation was din, was Allah Elokim. But Hashem b'kol shofar, when you blow the shofar, you add that new dimension of rachamim, of shem havaya, of the yud and the hey and the vav and the hey. In a certain sense, you're now adding that element of being freed from the natural world and its limits. You go out of Elokim into the shem havaya. And maybe, in some way, that is the message of the shofar of Yovel, of the Jubilee year. Ukrasem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveh. Everybody should be free. Everybody should not feel that you are shackled by the previous owner of this property or the fact that you are an eved to something. What does it mean to be limited, to be a natural being? It means you're a slave to the physical desires that you have, to the this worldly hateva. So we come on Yom Kippur, Shul Yovel, and we say, everybody's free. The greatest expression of freedom is spirituality. It's the freedom to be true to yourself, which is your inner core, your neshama. So maybe that's why Rosh Hashanah is very much related to the shofar of Yovel. Because the shofar of Rosh Hashanah is the shofar of Vayipach Ba'ap of Nishmas Chaim. It's the shofar of Havaya. It's the shofar of transcendence, of not being limited by our physical body. It's the freedom to be true to your moral, spiritual compass, to your true self. That's what you're remembering, that you really are a being that was Vayipach Ba'apav. You were created with the Shem Havaya, not just with the limitations of the Shem Elokim. So when you blow the shofar, of course it's Malchios and it's Tshuva and it's Har Sinai, but it's also feeling free from the limits of the physical world. Free from the first 5 days of creation. Free from the initial Zachar and Nekeva. I'm not just biologically defined. I'm spiritually defined. That I have a breath. The Zohar says, we have the breath of Hashem in us. Yovel teaches us with the shofar that we're all free to pursue our destiny. Rosh Hashanah says, we're free to pursue our spiritual destiny. What is that? The ding? You are now free to move around the country, right? You're now free to move around the world. You're not limited by the shame of Elohim. You live in the shame of Havaya. You're free. We're free on Rosh Hashanah to be spiritual. And maybe that, of course, is going to be our first step in tshuva, to realize that we could step out of the bad habits that we had or the decisions that we made in the past that we feel hold us back, but that's not true. On Rosh Hashanah, when you blow the shofar, you say, you're Shem Havaya. You're connected to something that transcends. It's beyond the boundaries. Hopefully that can propel us to taking a fresh new look at our lives as we are blessed, please God, for all of us, for Ksiva V'Chasima Tova, a good year of Besuros Tovos, of continued learning together, of growing together, of good health, of Nachas and Gesund. We should continue to see growth, Mirat Hashem, this year and for many years to come.